So I want to know like prominent lines and like bridges, skulls, bone cells, different parts, medial, lateral, that kind of skull. Along with the nervous system and the hand and arm muscles, right?
Nervous system, none of them on the cat.
Right.
So.
Our nervous, literally, right. And then our bones, and then the cat's muscles, and then our muscles. Nope.
I think I'm just gonna stick to the cat.
Well, that's a lot.
Yeah, I think I'm just gonna stick to the cat muscles for the test.
What happened with that?
For the practice, but I'm just sticking to the cat muscles. Cause I've got enough, I've got like six cats in there. It's about how many muscle stations I wanna have considering the fact that I need to cover nervous system and all the bones. So.
We're just doing muscles? We're just doing muscles next week? Is that what you said?
No.
Oh, hold on, Freddie.
Cat muscles.
Yeah, I get to waste my whole Saturday.
You decided to be a professor.
Yep. So.
On a Saturday.
Hey, I didn't do it for Saturday. I'll take it though. Yeah, they're all right. Oh, yeah. I had that, I got a couple minutes.
Okay, a couple minutes? One, see.
I see.
I like this house. Good for you, you know, at my. And then that's when I have her tell me about, she's a good friend, she's like actually, she's tutorial. That was super helpful.
Oh, that's good.
But she didn't like, she didn't talk that way. Maybe something to do. I did that.
So what is that, you know, with the black, you know, and you have the gap?
Is he gonna ask us?
So.
I did it on the air.
I'm gonna tell everybody that they need to make their way into the throat. For the muscles. And that you need to do toward the gap. So a lot of people are gonna spend time going and cutting out, cutting into the actual tissue to try and see the muscles and identify them. And then, let's say you go look at other people's cavities, that's what's gonna be our practical. So this is gonna be, you go around and rotate through to see other people's cats.
The reason I'm asking is because I discovered this morning when I was on my way. Is I don't know what I did with my bumble. But technically my cat is obliterated already.
So, that's up to you. Now, if you go get him, come back, you're fine. I will be here till 2:20, and then at 2:20 I. So, yeah, that's the full lab time.
Well, yeah, I so actually was
in the class. Now we're good. All right. So, in this case, you're going to have your patellar surface. Your patella is going to rotate across that. If you notice, you do have these two facets that are formed here by the cartilage, and in between them you have a ridge. That ridge is what allows your kneecap to track the way it's supposed to. So, part of my knee injury that happened in the Marine Corps was due to the fact that these two facets have been actually, well, the ridge between them has been worn down. So my knee doesn't track like normal. It actually will pull off to the side. Part of that is due to the fact that it's a lot of impacts to the knee. So over time, you can wear down this cartilage and it will not look like it's supposed to. Okay, so this is a picture that's an ideal situation. If you see it in a patient, you'll be looking at it and you'll say, okay, that doesn't exactly look like it's supposed to. Well, that's due to damage. Okay? All right. So I'm gonna go back one slide real quick and then we'll pop back through. So the triangular patella, it is your kneecap. It articulates with the patellar surface of the femur. It is a sesamoid bone. It is located within the tendon of the anterior thigh muscle. It is embedded in that tendon. So there was a general consensus for a while that you had a tendon and then the patella and then a ligament, and then it came back around to where now it is just a tendon that this bone is embedded into. So the proximal end of the patella is the base and the distal tip is the apex. So in this case, the apex is the actual point. Okay? When you look at the kneecap, this can help you orient which one is which. Point the apex away from you and lay it on a surface, okay? It will lay on the side it belongs to. Okay, whether it points to the left or to the right, they're slightly different from each other. All right, so, you see them here. You have your point, your apex. If you feel on your kneecap, you can feel it tapers on the bottom side. Okay? Because your apex is on the bottom side, you're feeling this taper right here. Okay? Like I said, cheat sheet. Alright. So your tibia, it is the larger medial bone of the leg, the lower leg specifically. Okay, it is responsible for bearing weight along with your femur. It is the main thing that it does. Two concave depressions, so you have your medial and lateral condyles at the proximal knee end. So this is where you're going to have your knee joint. So this is what is going to bear the weight from your femur. Okay, that is where you have your two articular cartilages. If we go back and look at them, you have the two articular cartilages, one that's over the medial condyle and one that's over the lateral condyle. Okay, those two articular cartilages are going to articulate with the actual two medial condyle joint and medial condyle and lateral condyle joints of your tibia. Okay. So there's gonna be a better image later, we'll see. Alright. The condyles are separated by a ridge called the intercondylar eminence. The medial malleus is a palpable lump of bone that's found at the ankle and flat end of the distal epiphyses is the articular surface. So the flat end of the furthest away joint is going to be your articular surface and it is the component of the ankle joint. Alright, your medial malleus, bless you. So, when you actually go down to find your medial malleus, you can feel it right here, okay? It's that ankle bone, okay? What you always feel is the ankle bone, what you hit on things, okay? You are going to also have your lateral malleus, okay? Your lateral malleus, you don't necessarily feel it as much, okay? It's one that's hard to find. Okay, so I'm gonna finish up here, but I want to talk about this one. So the fibula, it is not the fibia, okay? I will, till the day I die, okay? It is not fibia, okay? And expect a big red X when you put fibia. Okay, so the fibula is the smaller bone of the lower leg of the pair. Okay? It is the lateral bone. So it is on the outside. It's the lateral surface. If you take a hit to the lower portion of the leg on the outside, you may have a fibular fracture. If you take a really hard impact, you may have what's called a tib-fib fracture when you fracture both. Okay? It's more likely that you are going to take and fracture the fibula than the tibia. Okay? So the head of the fibula is going to articulate with the lateral tibia, and it is going to be proximally at the proximal tibiofibular joint. Yes, all of these words are necessary. Okay, so the fibula is going to expand into the palpable lateral malleus distal to the distal tibiofibular joint. Okay, why do you think I have an eight up here? Okay, lateral malleus is going to articulate with the lateral talus, and the talus is going to help stabilize the ankle joint. So, not here, it is here. So, you can see your talus right here. Your talus is going to then pivot off your calcaneus, okay? Your calcaneus and your talus are ones that I would know, okay? I said you don't have to memorize them all, these are important, okay? So, your talus and your calcaneus. Those are the ones that I just can't bring myself to actually open. All right. So, yeah. All right, in this case, you notice there's an angular depression at the head of your fibula. That angular depression is what allows you to figure out how exactly it's going to sit onto your tibia. Okay? You wanna, if you pair these upright, you'll find that angular surface fits in like a glove. Okay? Because I know in the lab they're disarticulated. You can use as a guide to get you in the right realm the lateral malleus. Okay? You should know that this lateral malleus should be angled laterally. Okay? And then you have your medial malleus, which should be medial. So if you pair the two together, you can figure it out because they should create this nice little cup. Okay? And this cup is where your talus is going to sit. And below that, you're going to have your calcaneus. Okay? That is part of the load-bearing portion of your body. All right. So you do have the interosseous membrane, which is a membrane between the two bones that helps hold them in place. Okay, your tibial tuberosity is a structure that is on your lab. Your medial condyle of your tibia is on your lab. Your proximal tibiofibular joint. It is the joint that is closest to your knee, that is the joint between the tibia and fibula. Okay. Tibia and fibula, man, I just, yeah, Freudian slip. Alright, I'll blame Freud for that one. Your distal tibiofibular joint. Okay, so now all you need to know is that there are the two bones, the tibia and the fibula. They combine the name to tibiofibular, and you got a joint there, and you have a distal and a proximal. Distal is the most distant away, proximal is the closest. We good? Alright. So the foot, there are seven tarsal bones in your foot. It connects the leg to the foot. Metatarsals, they're numbered 1 through 5. Pretty much the same exact way as your hand. Your phalanges, you're gonna have them, so you have them in toes, your toes, 2 to 5, have proximal, middle, and distal phalanges. Your big toe, also known as your hallux, okay? And on a test, I would want you to refer to it as a hallux, okay? Has only a proximal or distal phalange. So it does not have that medial phalange, just like your thumb, okay? You should notice that there is actually a correlation there. It does not have the medial phalange. All right, so in this case, the starting point for memorizing your actual tarsal bones is going to be under the toe. So you have your talus, and then your calcaneus, then you have your navicular, and then you have your median, intermediate, and lateral cuneiform bones. The tarsals are easier to memorize than the carpals. However, I'm not asking you to memorize them for this class, but if you're going into nursing school, I would suggest it because they love to do that. Okay? Personally, if I wanted to be mean in this class, I would take your tarsal and carpal bones and disarticulate them. In other words, just give you one and ask you which one it was. But that's something that I think is better reserved for PA, NP, whatever school you want to go to after this. They can be mean like that. Okay? So, why not use the time now to study things like that if you know you're headed down that road. Alright. Here they are highlighted so you can see them. Alright. So, we need to roll right into the axial because I am behind now. So, axial skeleton. In other words, in this case, it is outlined in green. Okay? So, the adult skull, two sets of bones. You have cranial and facial bones. Bones are joined together by sutures. These are fibrous and movable joints. Okay? So, they are mainly made of fibrous connective tissue, and they are put together by two bones that are forming into that fibrous connective tissue, and usually there's an overlap that creates a suture-like appearance. It looks like they're sewn together. Okay? That's where suture comes from. So that's something that I previously talked about in the last lecture, 6. Okay, so the question is up there. Can you explain the anatomy of the skull with respect to embryonic development? Okay. Go back and review that. Only the mandible is attached by a freely movable synovial joint. Okay, that's where it allows you to do things like this. Okay? Because it's freely maneuverable synovial joint. Everything else is stuck in place. Okay? Part of the reason why is because you have basically armor plating on the outside of the most important thing besides your circulatory tract and your respiratory system. Okay? I mean, technically everything's important, but those are the things that if you lose, your life expectancy is very short. Alright. So, blown up skull. I used to have one of these. I don't have one this year, so good luck. In this case, so you have the bones themselves. If you look at them, they have this rough edge. If you ever get to see the disarticulated, I have one blown up, but it's in a case and I think it's real, so I'm not going to use it because I don't want to break it. Okay, but this is what forms the sutures. It is a thick, flat bone that is, during development, it is actually merging in together. And when this happens, you get these finger-like joints that come together. And that's, like I said, what leads to being called a suture. Okay. A lot of this is just memorizing. Okay, because you're not going to have time to go back through and actually figure out why these terms are the way they are. They have meaning. Okay? Vomer. So vomer is one of my favorite ones. It is the straight up and down bone inside your nasal cavity. Main reason why is because you see vomering teeth in fish. You see the use of vomers in other areas that I've done research in. But it's just one bone. So now you take and look at, okay, this is your maxilla. So your maxilla is going to be the bone that you use to articulate with your mandible to macerate. Okay, a lot of M's in there because they all coincide. Okay, all right, lacrimal bone is a lovely little small bone inside the skull that you should probably know the location of. Okay, along with your palatine, which helps form the palate, your hard palate. Okay. You have your zygomatic bone, which helps form the zygomatic arch. And off of your temporal bone, you have a zygomatic process. That zygomatic process attached to the zygomatic bone creates a zygomatic arch, which is what helps hold your eye in place. When I was in Corpus Christi, there was an incident where an individual was walking down the street and somebody decided he wanted to fight him, so he came up and just socked him in the face. The individual hit so hard he ruptured the zygomatic arch, the eyeball dropped, and the individual, because he was passed out and not breathing for a while, ended up with brain damage. So he was hospitalized and ended up basically on life support. So that zygomatic arch and the brain trauma in that case is what led to the individual not being able to recover. So it's a fairly important structure, okay? A lot of times with boxers, if they have not had enough impacts to the face, as weird as it sounds, they haven't added bone to their zygomatic arch enough to where they can take the impact. So it will break, and then you have to have reconstructive surgery to put your eyeball back in place if they can get it right, okay? So it's a very important bone, especially your facial structure. All right, your occipital bones, your parietal bones, and your frontal bones, their temporal bones are all named, and the regions of the brains were named for what bone they're associated with. So if you know the regions of the brain, you should be able to figure out a lot of the bones inside the actual cranium. All right, so you have your inferior and superior and medial nasal conchae inside the cranium. You have your nasal bones. Your nasal bones are usually the ones that they go through and break if they are trying to do a nose reconstruction surgery. Okay, so if you ever actually see where they have a little hammer and the chisel and they're hitting up into somebody's nose, those are usually the bones they're trying to fracture. And they fracture them and hope they reform in the shape that they set them in. Okay, and that's what helps hold the actual nose open. And if you watch that Botched show, you can actually see in there they will take rib cartilage and reform it to actually make the sides, the lateral sides of the nose, along with breaking that bone. You have your ethmoid bone, another bone you should know. It's one of the smaller bones inside. You are also going to have for your ethmoid and your lacrimal, your palatine, and your maxillary bones, you will have embedded sinuses, okay? Now in your sphenoid. So, all right, cavities of the skull. So your orbits contain your eyeballs. There is a circular muscle around that eye socket, okay? You also have another circular muscle that is around your mouth. And you have the last circular muscle, which is around your sphincter, okay? So, these help close down these openings. So we haven't got there yet, we will. Your nasal cavity is going to house sensory receptors for smell. You house nerves that are coming off of that olfactory bulb, okay? And that olfactory bulb is connected to the olfactory nerve, cranial nerve. All right, so your oral cavity is surrounded by teeth and tongue. Okay, so it's, I read the back. Surrounds teeth and tongue. You want to keep this oral cavity moist. Most of the orifices and openings of your body you want to keep moist, because if you don't keep them moist, they tend to dry up and close. Okay? Other cavities are going to contain organs for hearing and balance. So you have your paranasal sinuses. So paranasal sinuses are the ones I hinted at earlier. You get these lovely little cavities that give us all kinds of sinus problems, right? They're the main site of your mucus production. That's why they give you the problems, okay? Because you have an allergic reaction, so the sinuses inside your head start overproducing mucus to try and get rid of the allergen, okay? That's the general push, and that's why you get the sinus pain and pressures, because you get a backup in one of those sinuses, okay? Or a pair of them. I was told a trick a long time ago that if you take and press on it, it will help. What you're doing is if you're pressing on that bone above the sinus, you're taking that sphere and you're putting pressure here. So you're gonna push some of that mucus out. And that's the hope, is that you start it like a bottle of old school ketchup, okay? So once you get an old school ketchup bottle, the glass bottle going, it'll keep going as long as you know what you're doing, okay? So same thing, you drop the pressure in that cavity, you apply pressure there, you can actually drain some of your nasal sinuses that way. Don't apply too much pressure because the bone is fairly, it's not built up, okay? It's not gonna be, basically don't hit yourself there with a hammer. Okay? All right. I know the desperation that comes with sinus allergies. All right, so four bones surrounding the nasal cavity contain large sinuses and or the paranasal sinuses. So they are paired, para, one on each side. It is lined with mucous membranes to filter, warm, and humidify the inhaled air. You are going to produce a lot of mucus at your paranasal sinuses. The cavities also reduce weight in the skull and enhance voice resonance. I don't really necessarily agree with the reduce the weight. I don't think that was anything that was ever an evolutionary advantage. You have a lighter head, so you survive. Okay? It was lighter by 2 ounces. Okay? Not really seeing where that fits in, but somebody came up with it and somebody uses it all the time. Voice resonance? Yes. Okay? Mucus production? Isolation? Yes. Those are the two things that I think are the most important. Because you want to protect those mucus-producing cells from damage like desiccation. If your nasal cavity gets too dried out, that tissue starts to die. If you lose those mucus-producing cells, you can never get that tissue back right. Okay? So, that's one of the big importances. Enhancing voice resonance. So, you having your own vocal resonance, it changes slightly if you change those cavities. My cavities have been changed. Okay, I went in and I have what's called a balloon sinuplasty. You take a little balloon on a tube, stick it up in that cavity, expand it until it hits the point where it touches, then they grab, pull, and inflate. And what happens is they rupture all the bones around the opening of that nasal sinus. Okay. They open up that, and then once the swelling goes down, hopefully, at that point, all of the mucus-producing cells can push the mucus out and flows out like it's supposed to. Okay? We're good? What's up?
The four bones is the sphenoid, the ethmoid, the maxillary, and the palatine, right?
That's pretty sure, yes. I need to double-check the palatine. But all the other three, yes. So, now frontal, that's one. It's the frontal bone. So, you have the frontal, the sphenoid, the maxillary, and the ethmoid. Okay? Alright. So, now you get all the fun little details. Okay. In this case, this helps you see all of the sutures that y'all were looking at a couple weeks ago and trying to figure out. Okay? So, this is something that was in lab. Okay? So, the ones that are listed on your lap, you need to know. Okay? So, the squamosal suture, pretty sure is on there. Your parietal mastoid is on there. Your occipital mastoid. Your mastoid foramen, I'm pretty sure, is on there. Your styloid process is on there. Okay? Your parietal bone, your parietal foramen. Your sagittal suture, your lambdoidal suture, those are all on your lap, okay? So I suggest you spend some time with this diagram, okay? Even if you blow it up. All right. So, for this is a very old school diagram. I had never seen it until I actually saw this in this slide set. I'm just going to say that pretty much the only thing you need to know on here is that diagnostic arch. And we'll move on. Okay. So, your temporal bone, you should know the pieces of your temporal bone. Okay? So, in this case, one of the biggest ones is your zygomatic process. Your zygomatic process is coming off of your temporal bone to your zygomatic bone. Alright, so, and this is where I will say that you're limited to what you see on your lab. Okay, so go back through, reference your lab. Good? Alright. Okay, inside your frontal bone, you do have these small little foramen. They do exist. Part of this is just based on bone formation and movement of, well, blood into and out of the bone, which means you can move calcium in and out of the bone itself. So,
yes.
Alright, mandible. You are limited to what you see in your lab. Okay? So, your submandibular fovea on your lab. Your myelohyoid line on your lab. Okay? The body of the mandible on your lab. The digastric fossa on your lab. Alright. Your mental foramen on your lab. You should know that one. Okay? The ramus of the mandible is one that is on your lab, and it's actually talked about a little bit. Your coronoid process and your condylar process, you should know them. Okay, your condylar process, if you look at it here, is this process in this region. You have your head of your mandible here. If you notice, it's tapered in, like I said previously. Your coronoid process is what allows you to articulate off of your condylar process. So you got this condylar process that sits up here and it holds its place. Then you're going to have your coronoid process sticking up. This is what you pull on to actually macerate. All right. So,
we got the
question about this. What did you say about the skull? You said just no. The direction of blood flow?
This one? Talking about here? No, I was just letting you know that the actual foramen right there on the frontal bone, those do allow for blood flow.
Okay.
Alright. Okay. So, your orbit. Alright, this is where things get fun. Your orbit is made up of a lot of bones of your skull. Okay? You have a lot of sutures in this area. You also are going to have a lot of foramen. Okay, so you're going to have your optic canal. Your optic canal is where your optic nerve is going to run through. Beyond that, it runs to your optic chiasm. Okay. You are going to have your bones color-coded in this. So your ethmoid bone, you can see here is a very small portion in the actual posterior portion of your orbit. Then you're going to have your fulmar bone in this case. So this is posterior medially. The nose is here. Okay, so on the inside you have your fulmarine bone. Your fulmarine bone is what helps make the majority of the upright just inside of your eye. Now, on the outside you're going to have your maxillar bone. So your maxilla are going to come up and make the outer portion of your eye. Then you are going to have your zygomatic bone, which takes care of the rest on the outside, and then your frontal bone, which is going to take care of the overall arch. You have your sphenoid bone on the outside, so lateral to the eye socket, the lateral portion of the eye socket, and the posterior portion of the eye socket. All right. So, if I remember correctly, there are about 5 to 7 foramen that it asks you to know in this area of the skull on your lab. The rest of them are small enough to where it's hard to see on the actual skull itself. For the purposes of this class, what I want you to do is you're going to need to know the foramen that you can see on the molded skull that you have access to. The those are what I will use on the test. Okay? Not all of the foramen you can see, because they're so small that when they inject it, they don't actually have the inserts that they would need to make the cavity like it should be represented. Okay? So just keep that in mind. I will be using the ones you have available to you. Okay? Good?
In this one, there's only two obvious ones, the zygomatic facial and the intraorbital, because the one at the top, the anterior posterior ectomoidal foramina, will that be one that you want us to know?
Those are ones that I don't think show up in the actual molded one.
So then what would the other ones be?
So there's a, okay, so you have your intraorbital foramen here, which you can't see, okay? You are also going to have your infraorbital sulculus, which you can see, and your infraorbital fissure. Your zygomatic facial foramen, you can't see on there. It just doesn't go all the way in. Okay? Let's see. I'm trying to remember what you can see. Your superior orbital fissure, you can see in there. It is usually the more open region of your orbit. If you're out the canal, of course, you can see. So that's maybe four or five that was listed there. Okay, those are the primary ones. Well, thank you for asking. Okay, so your sphenoid bone. So, in this case, this is your sphenoid or anterior view of your orbital surface and your foramina with associated cranial nerves. So, through your canal here, you are going to actually have 3, 4, and 6 that are going to innervate. And if we go back to reference this, you also have number 2. So, your cranial nerves are coming through this superior orbital fissure. This is your superior orbital fissure. Okay? Don't really think that is something I would put on a test or not. Okay. Alright. So, diagrams that you can go back through and look at overall. I'm not going to spend my time going through reading small font. Okay, same thing here. You've already seen the skull. That's why I'm not trying to spend too much time on it. Okay? Alright, so placement of your inner ear structures. So they're in the temporal bone. You're going to have your semicircular canal ducts. From your semicircular canal ducts, you will have the vestibule, and beyond that, you'll have the cochlea. Okay? Off of your cochlea, you are going to have your vestibular cochlear nerve. Your vestibular cochlear nerve is going to pass through your internal auditory medius. Okay? We're good? Alright. So, if you have seen all of this before, the anatomy of the ear, I'm pretty sure we already went through all of this with special senses. So, I'm just going to move on. Okay. Alright, so what these things are. So, I wouldn't worry about these. That's good. Okay, so male versus female skull. Alright, so there are four obvious differences. The forehead of the male skull is sloped and the female's is straight. Okay, so that is all going to be superficial when you go to figure this out. The male's supraorbital ridge is more prominent. What do you consider more prominent? Okay. Mandibular angle of the male skull is closer to 90 degrees, and the female skull is generally greater than 90 degrees. Okay. Your mastoid process of the male skull is larger and more prominent. So, these are things that you can compare and determine post-mortem, okay? After they die. But really and truly, comparing these two and figuring out which one is male and female, that is something that is fairly ambiguous. Okay, I have met men that have had feminine features in their face, and I have met women that have had masculine features in their face. My aunt has a condition where she overproduces testosterone, so her skull actually looks more like a male skull. She has male facial features. She has the heavy cheekbones, the square jaw. Okay, it's really and truly, it is somewhat ambiguous. Not something I would ask you. This is more of an FYI for you to know. If you want to move into anthropology, this becomes more important. Okay, study of dead humans. Alright, so the hyoid bone. Hyoid bone is a C-shaped bone. It is superior to the larynx. It does not articulate with any skull bones or any other bone for that matter. It is a free-floating bone. In your cats, you will have a hyoid that is free-floating. You will also have clavicles that are free-floating. In humans, the clavicles are actually attached. Okay, that is part of what allows a cat to be able to squeeze through an opening the size of its head, and you have to be squeezing through something the size of your shoulders. Okay, that's one of the big differences between us and cats. Alright, your hyoid bone provides numerous attachment points for muscles. This is basically a pivot point for a lot of your throat muscles. When you look in your cat, and that's what I suggest you do today, is to go through and look at the muscles in the actual throat of your cat. Okay? And if you can get it, the muscles on the side of the actual cranium, muscles on the side of the skull, so the masseter muscle, okay, and your temporal muscle. Some of y'all have probably butchered the insertion of the temporal muscle, just an FYI. It provides numerous attachment points for muscles. It is involved in swallowing and speech. All right. So, the vertebral column. There are 24 single vertebral bones that are separated by intervertebral discs. They are hyaline cartilage discs. You have 7 cervical vertebrae, 12 actual thoracic vertebrae, and 5 lumbar. And in the sacrum, you have 5 that are fused to be one continuous piece of bone. Your coccyx, you have fused 4 vertebrae in this case. This is the remnant of what used to be a tail. There is actually a picture sitting in the lab. If you look to the right of the big sinks in the back, there's a picture, bless you, of a child born with a tail. Okay? It has happened. It is something that could happen. It depends on development and genetics. But at one point, this shows evidence that we did come from tail ancestors. Okay? Alright. So each one of these sets has numbers. So usually they're abbreviated with the first letter. Cervical is C and 1 through 7. Your first cervical vertebrae, this is one of the most notable, is the atlas, okay? And your second cervical vertebrae is the axis, okay? So the way that this was named, if you've ever heard in Greek mythology of Atlas being the one that holds the world up, okay? It is holding the world up. It's holding your skull in place. The axis allows for the axis rotation. So, your atlas is holding the world up, it's holding your skull, your cranium. Your axis allows for pivotal rotation. So it's allowing you to do things like this, okay, in conjunction. You've got one that allows forward and backward motion, and one that allows side to side motion and rotation. All right, so you should know that those two have specific names. That's C1 and C2.
Which one has the dens on it?
Has the what?
The dens.
Dens?
That little... The dens?
It should be the Atlas. Should be the Atlas. Okay. So, functions of the spinal cord, protection and support of the head and neck. So, the actual vertebrae, when you get to the body, the most anterior aspect of the vertebrae. So, this is the actual flat, disc-like piece of the vertebrae itself. You have your intervertebral disc, which sit on top of the body. Okay. The vertebral foramen is the hole inside the vertebrae which the spinal cord is going to pass through. And together, they're going to form the vertebral canal. You want to protect this, but you also want to be able to move. If all of your spinal vertebrae were fused, you wouldn't be able to move anything but your appendix, like your appendicular skeleton. That would be all that you could move. Everything else would be rigid. You wouldn't be able to do this. Okay? Which is an evolutionary advantage to us. Superior inferior articulation processes. So these are going to form joints between the successive vertebrae. There are specific names for these. I don't think you need to know them as of right now. You have your transverse processes. So the transverse processes are going to project laterally, okay, from the vertebrae. And you have your spinous process, which is going to project posteriorly. Okay. So when you look at this, your spinous process is what you're feeling back here. Okay. So beyond your spinal process, as you go in, you're going to have inside your vertebral foramen where your actual spinal cord is going to pass through. You have these transverse processes. Off of these transverse processes where your ribs are going to attach. Okay? And then you're going to have the body, which has the actual hyaline cartilage discs on top of them that allow for the movement between them. Okay? If you have a pinched or slipped disc, what's happened is you've taken these two vertebrae and you've shifted one off to the side. And what's happened is now it's hinging off to the side a little bit. When you move just right, it shifts and it will pinch the nerve that is running across your pedicle. Okay? So that's where you get the nerve pain from. It's because you're pinching that nerve. That's where it says you have a pinched nerve. Okay? A slip disc is when you have that slip in it and they're no longer aligned right. That is where chiropractors come in, or if chiropractic care doesn't help it, then surgery. Okay? Alright. So, you have an inferior vertebral notch, and you are going to have a superior vertebral notch above that. Between your inferior and your superior, that's where you are going to pass the nerve through. You have your inferior articulation facet of your transverse process. In that case, that's where your rib's going to attach. You have two places where your rib's going to attach. All right. So, pedicle. Pedicle is a term that is used a lot. Pedicle and fish is what connects the caudal fin to the rest of the body, so the tail fin. Okay, it is used quite a bit. So in this case, the pedicle is connecting the body to the processes and the neural arch. Okay. All right. So the cervical vertebrae are easily identified by the transverse foramina, and they're going to be found in their transverse processes. It allows passage of the vertebral arteries and veins. So your atlas is C1. This lacks a it lacks a ventral body because it is not supporting nearly the weight. Okay? It is only supporting your head at this point. It will articulate with the occipital bone and with C2, which is going to be your axis. Your atlas is mainly responsible for forward and backward motion. Okay, your axis, so this is the dens you were talking about. my bad. So the dens is on the axis. It is the odontoid process. It's the prominent superior tooth shape projection. It articulates with the atlas. So this allows for the no motion. Okay? All right. So
two areas between where the C1 and the C2 are, as opposed to like the thoracic and the lumbar, are they primarily cartilage in between?
Okay, between these two, they will have articular cartilage, but they will not have the discs,
right?
Because they don't actually have the body. They're not supporting the same weight. But once you get below C2, they should, if I remember correctly. So, this is the articular cartilage. Once you get below here, let's see if I can figure it. So, it's your lumbar vertebrae when they come in with the vertebral disc. So, the intervertebral disc will be lumbar. Inside all of your cervical vertebrae, you are just going to have this little piece of articular cartilage between them.
So if it's the cartilage, then there's like children who are first born and not hold their head, right?
They don't have the muscle structure built up to hold their head up yet, because they've spent, before they were born, they spent their whole life in fluid. And that fluid, that amniotic fluid, has provided support along with the actual placenta itself. So they haven't had to hold their head up against gravity. So when they're born, they have the muscles there, they're just not nearly as strong. So over time they develop that. That's why a child's head will just fall. They still have all of the structure there. They just don't have the muscles to hold and pull off of that structure. That answers your question. So, all right. In this case, the dens is actually reaching up into your atlas in this case, and that's what's allowing for the articulation. You do have a transverse ligament which is going to hold it in place. You have C1 atlas, C2 the axis, and then you're going to have your vertebral prominence. I usually don't talk about the vertebral prominence being there, but you have your cervical vertebrae. You have 3 through 7 besides the two that have specific names. All right, you can see here what I was talking about the nerves coming through as they pass through. This is where if you have a pinched cervical vertebrae, you have a whole lot more issues, because you are talking about a larger, more prominent nerve that you are pinching in this case. Okay, good?
That one's the what?
What's that?
The big
okay, so you have more of your nerves going to your face and neck that are coming out of this region, your cervical region. Okay? All right. So your thoracic vertebrae, there are 12. They are larger than your cervical vertebrae with heart-shaped bodies. The circular vertebral foramina are long spinous processes that are going to point inferiorly, so down. The superior and inferior transverse costal facets are the 3 points of articulation with the ribs. Your lumbar vertebrae, there are 5 of them, the largest and heaviest of all vertebrae. These are the ones that don't have anything else to support them. There is no rib cage there. Okay? So, they are all by themselves. They are the joint or the connection between your thoracic vertebrae and your actual sacral vertebrae. Okay? So, all right, the largest and heaviest of all vertebrae, they're well suited for bearing the weight of the torso. When you get problems, if you are bending over to grab something and you are rotating that spine as you bend it over, okay? You are creating a lever and you're creating pressure points at each one of these. Okay, so the load that you are bearing is distributed However, it's distributed at one of the weakest points, which is actually the cartilage discs. So that's how you end up throwing your back out when you reach over to grab something and end up pinching in there.
Right, you should bend with your knees.
Yep, that's why you should always lift with your knees. Large kidney-shaped bodies, in this case, they are going to have thick spinous processes that are going to point posteriorly to the back, and the vertebral foramen are going to have a flat triangular shape. All right, so, I'm not big on a comparison here with giraffes and moose, but you can look at how the neck is shaped and what you're actually going to get process-wise. But in this case, you have a large thoracic process that comes off. It looks like a giraffe. The moose in this case is the lumbar vertebrae. Okay? It has a much shorter process, the spinous process coming off of it. It's thick and blunt. Mainly because when you want to take and pull on something, if you want to pull hard, you want it to be thick and robust. Okay? That is where you are going to have a lot of your motion. Okay? This kind of motion. You're pulling off of those processes. All right. You can see here the interconnection between the vertebrae. Okay? So you're inferior articulation process and your superior articulation process. These are also called zygapophyses, but, okay, we're not going to go there, okay? So, they articulate with each other, and they are actually sloped to fit in at an angle, primarily because if they are shifted at that angle, when you have movement in your thoracic cavity, it puts it to where that joint becomes rigid from one direction, okay, and movable from other directions. All right, so you do have your intervertebral discs, which are hand and cartilage, your spinous process, transverse process also. Okay, so yay, vertebral anatomy 101. So, all right, the basics of what I've covered so far is what I do expect you to know. Inside of your cervical vertebrae, you are going to have these transverse foramen. Okay? These transverse foramen, if you notice, you don't see them in the thoracic or the lumbar. So that is one difference between them. All three do have a spinous process. You are also going to all three have the vertebral foramen, okay? And you have your superior articulation surfaces, processes, and a facet, okay? And you're going to have your inferior articulation process, okay? Superior and inferior articulation. Good? All right. And I previously talked about your inferior notch here. Your inferior notch is where you are passing those nerves through, so that pinched nerve or slip disc causing the pinched nerve is because it is being pinched here. Okay? Alright. Structures of the sacrum. So, 5-fused sacral vertebrae form a curved triangular shape. Posterior boundary of the pelvic cavity. You have the superior surface, the base is going to articulate with the L5 vertebrae at facets. And your sacral promontory, so it is a bone projection at the anterior margin of the base. So, in this case, this is your sacral promontory. Okay, it's a prominent ridge. That's where it gets its name from. Prominent ridge on the sacrum. All right. Your belly is two smooth regions found lateral to the sacral promontory. So you're going to have your lateral ali, one on either side. And then you're going to have your auricular surface, which is going to actually attach to which bone in your pelvis?
Iliac.
So. Alright, so your sacral canal, in this case it's the opening that's continuous with the vertebral canal. On the posterior surface, it allows for passage of nerve roots. At this point, you've already hit your caudate quina. So all you have is the nerve roots that are passing through your sacral region. Okay, so in this case, you're going to have your sacral canal, which is just going to pass a certain set number of nerves, mainly one of them being sciatica. Okay. Alright, so the medial sacral crest is the ridge of the bone used by sacrospinous process is found at the posterior boundary of the sacral canal. So, medial sacral crest. Okay. It is this region here that's the fused spinal processes. Yes. Yes.
Where does it go through the spine that direction, or does it branch off to the pelvic?
I think it branches off at the caudate quina. Don't quote me on it. But I think it does. I'll look it up and see.
Double check. Because it doesn't go through the sacral canal.
I don't think so. I don't think it cuts through the sacral canal. I think it's going to, if I remember right, it's going to pass through. It's going to pass through your pelvis. Okay, so, all right. And then your sacral foramina, there are the four holes that are going to be paired. Okay, one on either side, sacral foramina.
There's a lot here, I know. But we're not going to be paired. It's just going to focus on the manual part, right? For the bones.
Everything that's on the lab manual is what I'm going to focus on. It is, and that's part of this class. This is another one class. Okay. All right. So, the thoracic cage. So there are form. It's going to form a cage to protect the major organs. So you have your sternum, which is a T-shaped bone. The top portion of that's your manubrium. You have. It's the superior portion where the clavicle is going to articulate that I talked about earlier. You have your suprasternal or jugular notch. This jugular vein is going to pass through the posterior toward the cervical region. So.
I hate how the pictures are not right next to the definition.
Yeah. So. Yep, sorry. It's something I'll probably fix once I get time. So you have your suprasternal notch, which is where your jugular is going to pass through, your external jugular. All right. So the body itself. So the body of the sternum is the middle portion, and this is where it's going to attach to your costal cartilages. And your pectoral muscles are also going to attach to your fascia. They're going to attach in that region to articulate off of it. So they're going to pull off of your sternum. Your xiphoid process is the inferior portion. You can feel it if you feel around right in here. Your xiphoid process, of course, if you feel too hard, you'll find that there are main receptors there. Inferior portion and indirectly attaches to the costal cartilage to the sternum. So, your xiphoid process is fairly superficial, but it does allow for your abdominal muscles to insert. Okay? So.
So what happens when it breaks off?
Pain?
No, but like when it breaks
off. The hope is that it does actually start to form that bony matrix and come back. It doesn't always, and then you end up with, I think, I don't know if it's this class or my other class, I was talking about it. There's an individual who had a broken humerus, and because of overuse, the ends just, they ended up actually taking and encapsulating. so they can move across each other. So whenever he flexed his bicep, instead of his arm coming up like this, his elbow came closer to his shoulder because it was the bones were collapsing. So he would pick it up that way. An individual that lived on an island that was isolated and had nobody to come help him, so he had to keep fishing with him.
CPR, the pressure and don't break that.
Yeah,
well, but you're telling me right now that
it's not the only muscle attachment point for your abdominal muscles. Okay, so that's part of the reason why. They hope that it comes back and fuses again, but it's not worth losing someone's life. You can deal with the pain in the floating side foot process. Okay.
Is it cartilage?
No, it is bone.
So it can flow without causing harm to other organs?
Generally, yes, but if it's got sharp edges, then it could. You're more than likely not going to have to check it. It wouldn't be fun to have it break, but it's not going to be an issue with time. Alright, so another 10 minute break, then we'll come back and I'll try to finish this off. Oh, actually, that is the last slide. So, okay, so rib articulation with the thoracic vertebrae. So, okay, that means I get the joints when we come back. Alright, so this case, you're going to have ligaments that are going to hold this rib into place. You're going to have the head of the rib, the neck of the rib, and they are going to articulate based off of the body and also off of these lateral ridges. So that's your two points of contact that allow the ribs to stay rigid along your thoracic spine. Okay? Your transverse costal surface is in here. And this is for your tubercle of your rib to actually articulate off of. Your spinous process, you have a lot of muscle attachment here. Your longissimus dorsi runs right there. Okay? Alright, so now I'm done. Alright, take 10 minute break. Chapter 8, joints.